everybody. Welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. This is the 9th episode of this podcast, and it's no exaggeration to say that it wouldn't exist without your continued support. So if you appreciate this podcast and are able to, consider heading out to patreon.com/firethesetimes to make a monthly donation of as little as $5 a month. It'll help keep this project going alongside all the other cool podcasts that are being developed at the Fire These Times, soon to be known as From the Periphery. And so yeah, that's that. I think that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to record because, I hate marketing myself, even though, it's like, it is a community-supported thing, and if you do want to continue hearing this podcast, god damn it, I've been depressed. I woke up today at 7 p.m. I woke up several times, but I just kept falling back asleep because what kind of world are we waking up to every morning? I just can't do it. It's been something that I've been doing for a few years now. I only became conscious of it like a couple of years ago that I do keep sleeping because once I wake up, I kind of realize, like, why would I want to wake up? And then there's also this fact that I would like to stay as tired the rest of the day, but also I kind of want to skip the day, you know? Because I think I definitely developed this in Lebanon, that for some reason, if shit was going to hit the fan, it would hit the fan during the day. Nothing seemed to happen from 8 p.m. onwards. So I would kind of stay sleeping throughout and then kind of catch up on what had happened. And it seemed kind of easier to catch up than to follow in real time. I don't know if that's good psychologically or emotionally, but that's sort of a thing that I find myself reverting back to. I've always had sleep problems, but this definitely seems much more related to A, what's actually happening, and B, my inability to process and to understand and to just live with it. I don't think anyone really has the answer. It makes me think of the last episode I recorded, the one where I talked quite a lot about my partner. And first of all, I got quite a few responses to that episode, and one of which is sort of a bit of concern about us as a relationship. Don't worry, we're fine. We've been together for 10 years, and I think the fact that I think the way that I do makes it such that those types of conversations and like deep level analysis are almost inevitable. There's actually a really funny Simpsons quote that kind of exemplifies me, where it's like Lisa talking to Mr. Burns. Mr. Burns asks her, So, what do you think of today's popular music? And then Lisa goes on and does her thing, like, oh, I think it kind of does this to the youth, and I think it nullifies. And Mr. Burns goes, my god, are you always on? So yeah, I am always on, and must be fun to be in a relationship with me. And being a bit public about that, having this podcast is definitely a sign that, you know, I'm always on, that I can't stop thinking, that there's a lot going on, and constantly trying to process, but also reanalyze for different outcomes, because I do notice that there's a lot of things we do, which is kind of hitting your head against a wall. Or what's that quote that's attributed to Albert Einstein, that insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results? I think about that when I think about how I've been approaching my activism, I guess, or how other people I see are engaging in activism. I think the very first thing that I ever wrote that was of any value is this essay called Depression and Revolution. And I wrote this a few months into the October 17 uprisings in Lebanon. Basically, I had become quite alienated from the very concept of the protest, especially because at that point, protests would happen less frequently and always targeting the same spot. And it was just a pattern. Go down, go to the parliament, get tear gassed, run away, get into a confrontation with the cops, run away, rinse and repeat. And it was like, after a few months of that, it's like, okay, are we just going to keep trying to do the same thing and expecting different results? And so I'm thinking the same thing now. It's been, 130 days of genocide? And a lot of us in Palestine solidarity groups, or even just as individuals, have been doing kind of the same tactics over and over again, and behaving as though this is still, you know, day 10 or day 20, but a lot has changed, and so our tactics need to change. And actually, I kind of want to analyze this in a way that slightly removes myself from the equation, because I think this is an analysis that's very valid, that I think a lot of people have had, not just in terms of protests and solidarity for Palestine, but other forms of protest for other causes. So, for instance, a lot of the Just Stop Oil or some of the climate protesters. You know what I mean? Like, how many times are we going to throw soup at the Mona Lisa before we decide that that's just not an effective tactic? And that the situation, whether ecological or in terms of colonial violence or any of these things, has reached a level such that we can't afford just to keep doing the same tired old tactics and expecting them to change and slowly developing them. Like, there is an urgency to really figure the shit out now and act accordingly. And so, what does escalation look like? And I've seen people talking about this on Twitter, and it's something I really rack my brain around, because especially as an immigrant, I'm very aware of the law. Like, I see it much more close and much more threatening than others. And basically, this is tying into why I even brought up my last episode, because what really scares me is that the people who are on the front lines, who are the most active in protests against the ongoing genocide, but also their, like, local governments' complicity and complacency with this genocide, and with it, you know, global Western imperialism, et cetera, are some of the most marginalized in these societies. You know, they're by and large migrants and POCs and asylum seekers, for whom taking such risks as potentially being arrested or surveilled by the state is much more threatening and risky than for, let's say, your average white European. Part of the frustration that you must have heard in the last episode comes from this projection of, you know, not just my partner, about white people in general, that there's a kind of quiet assumption if they agree or disagree with what's happening, you know what I mean? Who, like, their heart is in the right place. Because I hear this a lot from a lot of Austrians, a lot of Germans, that, like, actually most people are against the genocide. And I'm like, okay, so what? Where are they? I haven't seen them. Like, what does that do for me? What does that do for people in Palestine? Like, translating those sentiments into actions is what needs to happen. But yeah, I'm just not seeing it. And honestly, there are so many reasons why I've been feeling really depressed the last week. Part of it is, you know, that I think the futility of making an episode like I did. I mean, it feels weird to talk about the futility if you're listening to this, because I feel like I'm kind of undermining myself before I even begin. But yeah, it's all so futile. It all feels so useless. And I mean, I made this podcast because, you know, one thing I definitely don't want to do when I talk about depression, when I talk about my feelings, when I talk about despair, is to incentivize people into despair. I don't want to do that, you know? Like, I always want to find the silver lining. I always want to talk about these things so that we can process them and move on and then actually be powerful agents of change, etc., etc. But I'm just not seeing that. I'm not seeing it in myself. I'm not seeing it in others. Because, again, when we talk about what needs to escalate and that our responses need to escalate, we are talking about the limits of the law. We are talking about doing things that are risky. We are talking about sacrifice. And most people are just not willing to sacrifice. Most people are in pretty precarious situations as it is. Again, something that I feel really a bit upset about that I didn't mention in the last episode is that, like most people, my partner works 9 to 5. And that takes up most of their day and leaves them completely depleted when they get home. And little time to, like, be able to relegate to thinking about things that feel far away, but, you know, as I keep saying, are not actually that far away. It's just, it's there are certain things that, from my analysis, from how I see things, are necessary, but most people are not able to push themselves to live up to the challenge. Not by choice, again, by necessity. Like, the world will end on the trajectory we're in. The genocide will continue, will unfold, will reach its zenith. Like we're seeing now, they are attacking Rafah. There's 1.5 million people in an area smaller than most cities. And it's terrifying. It's fucking terrifying. It's horrible. It just blows my mind that there's these Twitter discourses about Mu'taz meeting with Mahmoud Abbas. I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit. This is incredible. Like, how our impotence manifests into this kind of need to have an opinion, to need to be relevant, but in a way that's just so destructive and petty and utterly useless. I've talked a lot of shit about Twitter, and Twitter is a horrible place, and so there's a lot of alternatives. And one of them is Blue Sky, and I've been on Blue Sky, but genuinely, it's insane to be on there. I can't stand it for more than... It's like going to just any cafe here, you know? A bunch of white people talking about their memes and their lives. And it's just like, I just find myself going on there just yelling at people. There is a genocide. This is happening in your name. Ha ha ha, funny Super Bowl joke. You are supporting genocide and you're complete. Like, you know what I mean? I've become angry again, and I don't like myself angry. I've become contemptuous, and I don't like being contemptuous. I don't know how to avoid it. I don't know if I can avoid it, but I kind of don't want to even try to convince people anymore. I kind of just been avoiding most people. I also woke up today to like really terrifying news in Lebanon that the Israelis have struck like several targets in Lebanon, including in Nabatiyye, which is not only really far away from the border, but is also like a city, like a civilian area. They killed 9 civilians, 4 of whom are children. And that's really fucking terrifying. Not just holding what already is happening and the incredible terror of it all and the injustice, but also how it can escalate and how it looks like it's escalating. And this goes back to what I talked about in the second episode when Israel attacked Beirut, which is this fear of escalation and then the kind of pre-grieving that I feel like I'm doing, you know, because we know where next. Sorry, I kind of dropped a succession inside joke there with pre-grieving. And for any of us who have seen the show, you know how well that works out. But so I have that constantly. And so every time I see the escalation, the desire for the Israelis to push the war further, to keep pushing Hezbollah's buttons, and to keep pushing to see how far it can go, it's fucking terrifying. And I have no idea how to continue. I find myself actually twitching these days and having really weird, like, reactions, you know? Almost as though I should change the name of this podcast to like Politically Insane, because I'm making noises, I'm twitching, I'm kind of like uneasy with my body, you know, just like uneasy being in the world at the moment. And I don't know, my muscles tense up. It's really weird. I mean, I don't want to center myself too much. Actually, I think a good way of bringing this all back to, if you want, the kind of thesis of this episode, even though I am just kind of rambling. Last night I read on Twitter, Palestinian from Nablus writing something along the lines of, the fire in Rafah will consume you, you know, that today is Rafah and tomorrow it'll be you. And if you don't stop it, it will come to you. And that's fucking terrifying, because it is exactly word for word. Well, sorry, not word for word, sentiment for sentiment. That very famous poem from the Second World War of first they came for the trade unionists, but I did not speak because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jew, but I did not speak for the Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. And that poem is really terrifying because the dude wasn't Jewish. He was actually like a Christian priest, you know, a German white Christian priest. And he was killed by the Nazis. Like, I think part of my frustration when I keep talking about white people, when I keep talking about the people who are not yet living within the bubble, sorry, not yet living within the real world, who are still living in a bubble, a subconscious feeling that they will be safe, that they will be fine. There's a feeling that because now it's so far removed, that it'll never come close. And I say this because they don't act as though there is that urgency that they may be next, you know, that they're somewhere down the line. And so, yeah, I think part of the reason that I actually feel like my mind is just constantly breaking, you know, alongside my heart, is because there's just, I think a lot about inertia, you know, the propensity for things to keep going in the same direction. Like, it's just so fucking obvious now that things have to change radically, not just for Palestine, for the entire world. Like, this is the decade that decides our human civilization as we know it. And there's just so much inertia. And, you know, we're talking about these huge systems of whiteness, of capitalism, of imperialism. Like, these are not small orders, but there's just this inertia that keeps them moving. And so trying to stop it or feeling yourself outside of it is a constant feeling of alienation from reality. I think actually there's some sentimentality to those early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, because there was a feeling that for a moment, capitalism stopped, that we were all kind of engaged in a similar struggle. And I don't know how everyone else experienced that, like, first lockdown, but I've definitely had this conversation wherein there's this feeling that, yeah, we were collectively doing something, and that kind of lifted spirits and kept us away from despair, because there was also a lot of despair. You know, a lot of people died and we lost a lot. But yeah, and so I think about that now because I have been thinking a lot about despair. I think a lot of us are combating this because we cannot fall to despair. We cannot. And if we do, they win. That's not saying don't take a break. This is something I've had to teach myself. Like, self-care is still important. Like, a big concept of this podcast is not to say that mental health practices are bullshit, but that they've been co-opted. That there's a lot of conceptions of self-care that is very complacent within capitalism, patriarchy, imperialism, etc., etc. And I reject it. But I don't reject the entire concept of taking care of yourself, whatever, you know what I mean? Taking a break, mindfulness. And we all need to take care of ourselves because we're adults and no one's going to save us. And it's at once a terrifying thing, but also holds within it the kind of potential for hope, which is no one's going to save us. And all we have is ourselves and each other. And we need to start showing up for each other more. I don't know if that makes any sense. I don't know if any of this makes any sense. I'm actually very surprised that I've done 9 episodes of this and that I'm planning on continuing, but I'm very surprised that any of them have not only been kind of, you know, sort of well received based on what people tell me, but that, you know, they're coherent at all. Because my mind is so scattered, and because I do have a tendency to like jump right into things. And then jumping out of them is pretty difficult. But that's my segue into ending this episode. I hope you appreciate that one. That was actually hard to come up with. And I don't know why, but every time I record these things, my mustache itches like crazy. I have no idea why. It never happens any other time when I'm talking or anything. So, I don't know. Fun facts for like behind the scenes. So, this has been another episode of Politically Depressed. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next week. everybody. Welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. This podcast is supported by listeners like you. If you've enjoyed these episodes and the work that I've been doing, consider heading over to patreon.com/firethesetimes to make a donation of as little as $5 a month. It'll help this podcast grow, as well as the project around it, which supports many other podcasts from and for the periphery. Becoming a member of our Patreon also gives you access to a lot of really cool perks, such as an invitation to our monthly hangout, where you'd get to meet me as well as all the other cool creators of all the other podcasts, as well as early access and exclusive content. If you're unable to support us through Patreon, then there are still other ways that you can support this podcast. You can leave a review or a 5-star rating wherever you listen to this episode. And yeah, I think that's about it. I hope you enjoy this episode. Ugh. Today's episode is going to be a little difficult for me. Like with all my episodes, I hope that I make at least one coherent point. I've been feeling especially raw today. Like really vulnerable and I don't know. I've been crying on and off and I can't really control it, you know? I really feel like I'm losing touch with, you know, my ability to even just control my emotions. I've also been feeling this really sharp pain in my heart, which is like literally heartache, but it feels so intense and it immobilizes me and I really can't do anything. I found myself like laying down for an hour, unable to do anything. This isn't what I want to talk about. I mean, I'm sure you can tell from the title that this is going to be a very different podcast in terms of what I've already talked about, but I just wanted to put you in the sort of a disclaimer, I guess. I don't know, shit's just fucked. Shit is fucked. I mean, from Gaza and the West Bank and southern Lebanon and Syria and northern Syria and Sudan. I don't know. It's too much. The only time that I'm able to just do stuff, like I'm not saying go out and party, I'm saying just do the dishes, I'm saying go do groceries, I'm saying go to a store or something, is when I'm kind of avoiding it, you know, avoiding thinking. And the problem with that is that the more I avoid, the more painful it is once it comes back into my mind, you know? I had this experience a few years ago where all of a sudden, you know, this is like a few years ago, but I was just sitting, I was on my computer, and I realized, fuck, I haven't thought about death for like 4 months. And then it destroyed me. Because there's that feeling of like, fuck, I could have died and I wasn't prepared. Or someone could have died and I wasn't prepared because I didn't think about it and I didn't process it. And so it's that like rushing back. And so I find myself kind of sitting, watching something, doing something. And then I remember, you know, people are starving in northern Gaza, that they're being starved, that there's this ongoing genocide, which many are calling just like Holocaust level atrocities, you know? They really do seem to want to kill all 2.4 million of them. And nothing's stopping them, and no one's stopping them. And the US, which is just, it's not just a supporter, this is their genocide too. God, I don't know, I don't want to get into this, like, you all know. It's just, so where I've been at vis-a-vis all those things is that I feel useless. And I think one thing where a lot of us are avoiding is confronting that uselessness. You know, for me, a lot of things end with death or like are connected with death. I do not want to die. It is an inevitability, however. And the only way that I'm going to like deal with it and confront it is to accept the fact that I am incapable of changing it, you know, or of stopping it. And I'm not saying that's the case in terms of like engaging in protests and like pushing for a ceasefire, pushing for an end to the genocide. I'm not saying, you know, genocide is inevitable. That's definitely not what I'm saying. But there's a certain level of impotence that I think we're avoiding confronting that doesn't have to be that way. As in, that exact impotence that I'm describing isn't an inevitability. Okay, I think I jumped way ahead of myself. The reason that I've been thinking a lot about this these days is that it has been about, what, 139, 140 days of genocide? And it's not stopping. And there have been massive protests around the world. And they don't seem to be doing much. You know, if we take like very basic metrics, we can't even get a ceasefire. Like, there has been some shifts here and there in the UK and Australia and New Zealand in terms of the governments. But meaningfully, you know, there haven't been any real changes. And so I really think it is important to think about really seriously the tactics and the strategies that we've been employing and implementing and participating in and advocating for. I mean, I'll say first off that one of the main reasons that I myself go to these solidarity protests is because this is precisely one of the things that Palestinians in Gaza are asking of us. You know, and that's not something that I'm willing to ignore. And I will keep going, and I do value them, and I see a lot of strength in them and potential, but I am worried that there is this kind of limiting a conception of protests as, you know, an ends. I see protests as a means to an end, you know? It's complicated. There are different factors. There are different types of protests, and there are some protests that in of themselves, you know, hold certain effects and change things, and there's a lot about visibility, and there's a lot about whatever, but this isn't going to be an episode where I dissect all the different types of protests and their effects and whatever. Like, there are books about this, and I'm sure they'll do it much better than I do. I will more focus just on solidarity protests that I've experienced, especially as it's something that's kind of new for me, because I don't know, the protests that I've been to in Lebanon were anti-government protests, you know? I've been to some solidarity protests there, but again, it's very different because protesting in solidarity with Palestinians in Lebanon is very different than protesting in solidarity with Palestinians in Europe. You know, I've never actually seen an Israeli flag until I got here. Because that's what it's like. You protest, you're like 10, 20, 30 people, and then one dickhead with an Israeli flag comes, and then it becomes like a conflict and whatever. There's also a huge difference where protests here are much more regulated. The one I went to about last week, the trams were still running, you know? We weren't like blocking the roads. It's literally like our chants are registered with the cops. I don't know, that specifically, I really wonder about the effectiveness. The effectiveness, but also I've been contemplating, what is the intended effect? Are we trying to reach out to other people? Are we just trying to do this like aesthetic of like showing ourselves to people around us, to social media? I mean, I know there are Palestinians in Gaza who see these, you know, who are hopeful by these sort of movements around the world. Is it to pressure the government? In Austria, the Austrian government has voted several times against a ceasefire. I think the Austrian government is one of the few that have also cut funding to UNRWA. And so there is definitely a need to like protest against that and be like, no. And some of the chants reflect that, you know, with shame on you. But yeah, I don't know. I just think the protest has its place, but it's not the end in itself. And I'm worried some people might think so. And I'm really worried about that because I think we've seen in so many cases that, you know, momentum dies out. Momentum has died out with a lot of these protests that I've been seeing, you know, that we've been seeing across Europe and in the US and across Asia and like in a lot of different contexts. I think part of that comes with a misunderstanding. You know, a lot of people go down and they expect it to be kind of instantaneous. We protest and then there's the fucking president on the windowsill and he's like, oh no, the people are rebelling. Okay, I better change policies. But obviously history moves much slower than that. But it's also like where we're starting from, you know? We don't have like a strong base. We're like sometimes like 200, 300 people at these protests, like really not many. And we're not like a very powerful constituency, if you like that kind of language. You know, we're a huge minority in the country in terms of those that show up. but also we're a minority of minorities. Like, I'm very aware that a lot of the people I share the streets with whenever I go to these solidarity protests are refugees, are asylum seekers. A lot of Syrians, for example. And actually a lot of Free Syrian flags, which I really appreciate. Also the first time that I've ever seen them live, which is particularly interesting. It was kind of a red flag in Lebanon because of, like, Hezbollah would kick your ass, you know? You'd instantly get into it. Like, people just knew, don't do it. Which was really fucked. There is one thing about protest that I really value, which is its ability to connect people. Ever since I got to this country, I've been looking for queer lefty Arabs of my age, you know, which is quite niche, especially in Vienna, with not a very big Arab population. And I've been meeting them through these protests, you know, I've been meeting people who it's kind of brings people together that share similar values, similar priorities, similar whatever. And I mean, like, there is definitely like a kind of social factor in terms of the loneliness and the feeling of I'm the only one that feels this way in the city, but then I go to these protests and no, I'm not the only one. But beyond that, I think the real political work that needs to be done, not just in solidarity with Palestine, not just in terms of pressuring the Austrian government to change its policies to whatever, but in general, in terms of political work against patriarchy, against capitalism, against imperialism, needs more than just protests. And it is the kind of post-protest thing. You meet, you gather, you sort of get to know each other, and then you do the actual work of organizing, which, again, is really complex and really based on respective contexts and like specific whatever is happening and where we're talking about. And even in the ones that I am a part of, I have no idea. I mean, I'm really worried about the word organize because it's kind of one of those words that you hear a lot, but what does it mean? But I don't know. What I kind of do, a thought experiment I have, is I pick something that is a good thing, you know, that I think is a good thing. And then I think about and I research, how did that come to be? Because there's this common notion that I really subscribe to, which is that power never commits suicide. That the way that people gained the rights for healthcare or to vote, it was never like some bougie elites where it's like, oh, let's give them healthcare. Like, no, these things were fought for and struggled for, and people died for these things. And so one thing that I've been thinking about is the weekend. Everyone likes the weekend. Like, the 5-day week sucks, but it's much better than the 6-day week, and definitely much better than the 7-day week, you know? And yeah, you know, you read into that history, or even the civil rights movement, and it's like, protests are a part of it, but there's also labor strikes, there's also civil disobedience, there's also direct action. And then there's also, you know, a lot of these things we discuss are within the category of nonviolent movements. You know, there are other tactics, there are other strategies, and I'm not advocating one way or the other. Like, that's something that's a bit difficult for me, actually, because, like I said in previous episodes, because of my legal status that I'm still not fully adjusted to, you know, as an immigrant in quite a surveilled and intense bureaucratic state like Austria, I feel like the panopticon is like I've internalized it, you know, like the state is in my head. And so literally when I think about anything where it's like a bit risky or a bit not, you know, possibly potentially illegal, like it's like a thought crime. I don't like that I'm going back to Orwell, but honestly, things feel like they're just returning to a kind of really basic dynamics. Anyway, whatever, sorry, I'm getting off topic. But the point is that I think there are a lot of other tactics that can be employed, and that the urgency, the stakes are way too high for us to still be doing the same tactics and expecting different results. And if not, I don't necessarily see that the tactics we are using, that people are employing, are fully thought out, you know, that there's an analysis there, that there's I hate the term theory of change because it's very NGO, but kind of like that. Like, So what is the point? What are we doing here? What are we trying to do here? And how are we measuring if it's a success or not? Is it just about how many people there are? But then, like, what if everyone joins the protest and then nothing changes? Like, what's the day after? God, I'm going to quote Zizek now, so prepare yourself. But Zizek has a thing about V for Vendetta, you know, that the film ends with the destruction of the British Parliament. And that's that. And he says, you know, I will sell my mother to slavery to see V for Vendetta too. What happens after the revolution? I sincerely apologize for anyone that was triggered by that Zizek impersonation. I don't know how well it comes across in audio format, because I do the hands and everything. So I hope it was still palatable. But I think he has a point there. You know, I think we do have a lot of conceptions of the revolution as an aesthetic, but then that really boring, laborious, long-term, and very risky engagement politically, organizing, the strikes, the mutual aid, the actual process of building power. Because my main problem with protests, just of and in themselves, is it's kind of like we're all collectively asking the government to change, or we're asking the state or something to change their ways. And yeah, what if they just don't? Like, what does escalation look like? Are we prepared for escalation? If not, how do we prepare ourselves? And even if we're not prepared, like, at least we know what we're not doing. At least there's like intent to the fact that we're doing this, because at the moment we can't do that. You know, like, I would never tell the people that are doing these solidarity protests to do anything risky, because a lot of them are in very, very precarious legal situations and, you know, would risk deportation and would risk arrest. But yeah, I think if there is any hope, if there is any potential in actually developing movements and building power that can be used to leverage, you know, that develops these mechanisms that would actually challenge the state, the government, whoever, it would need to be much more intentful. It would be much more organized. It would need to be much more studied, you know, and like rooted in a kind of history. I don't know. All this could be bullshit. But honestly, I am really worried that I'm going to these protests because I can't not. I'm really worried that I'm going to these protests and coming back home and feeling accomplished, when in fact I don't think that I did accomplish anything. And it takes a lot of energy. It's exhausting. Especially, I mean, I have experienced police brutality in Lebanon, and it's still in my body. I get really triggered when I see cops, and being out on the streets, it's taxing on one's body, and that says nothing about, you know, people who literally just cannot go down on the streets, who are too precarious, or who, let's say, have physical disabilities and are unable to join whatever. And so I'm not sure if I've mentioned in a previous episode that in 2020 I wrote an essay called Depression and Revolution, and I was really inspired by an essay I had read called Sick Woman Theory, which starts with the sentence, how can I throw a brick through a bank window if I can't even get out of bed in the morning? And I mean, that's a vibe. And that's my vibe. And I don't know, that's a real question. But also, even for those who are getting out of bed, like, they're not throwing bricks through bank windows. And all this to say, obviously protests do have their place. I would never advocate for people not to join these protests, especially these Palestine solidarity protests, but in general, other protests. Again, I just think that I'm not seeing the intent, and I'm not seeing a reckoning with the intent and a reflection of why we're doing this. There's just kind of a reflexivity of that's what you do. And I wonder, in a kind of way where it's like the energy that we are spending doing that, what is the stuff that we're choosing not to do? And Again, that's for everyone, you know, in their own situation to think about, but I think it really is something that should be thought about more and considered and discussed. So that's been another episode of Politically Depressed. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And again, if you want to support this podcast, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/firethesetimes and make a donation of, as I said at the beginning, as little as $5 a month. And if you're not able to support us through Patreon, leave this podcast a review and a rating, and you would get all of my appreciation and love. And yes. So that's it for me, and I'll see you all next week. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. Today's episode is going to be a lot shorter, actually, and a lot more concise than most of my other episodes because something specific happened today, and I mean, I know the title gives it away, but basically, it was really weird, and I want to share the whole story with you all while it's still fresh in my mind and kind of in my body, because it was really weird. But yeah, I think it's an important story because I think these people are everywhere, and it is a specific tactic and has different effects and intentions. But yeah, I think we should all be more vigilant in general at these Palestine solidarity protests. So yeah, as the title suggests, I did indeed catch a infiltrator. Basically, I went to another Palestine solidarity protest today here in Vienna, and we all met up and we started marching through like the main high street of the city. We were about 500, definitely no more than 500. And it was only like 10 minutes in that I saw someone holding a piece of paper with a flag on it. And when I got a bit closer, I noticed that it was the Iranian flag. More specifically, the old Iranian flag of the Shah. It sort of took me a few minutes to think about it, and then I said, no, I'm going to confront that person, or at least talk to them, and be like, you shouldn't carry that flag around here, because, well, I don't know if y'all know, but the Shah was, you know, a US and UK puppet, completely. He was a really important pawn for American Cold War geopolitics, and was also a very heavy Zionist. His Secret Service literally trained in Israel, and he was overthrown in 1979 by the Islamic Revolution. Well, I mean, there was a lot of revolutionary groups and movements, but ultimately what we now know as the 79 Islamic Revolution. Anyway, so this guy, I know the flag is used by other groups that are like anti-regime, like the current regime, but they're very sus, and they are also very Zionist. Like, I think some of the still-living Pahlavi heirs, one of them actually did, I think a year ago, take a photo with an Israeli soldier, and it was kind of like, feminism. Anyway, there's a lot of reasons why this flag is just not okay and not acceptable at a Palestine protest. And so I confronted him. And he didn't speak much, and I felt at the time he was caught off guard. He didn't strike me as Iranian. And I asked him where he's from. He said Syria. And I asked him if he spoke Arabic, and he said no. I was like, okay. Well, you still shouldn't be waving that flag because, well, reasons, and also this is Palestine, and look around you, you know? There are other flags, you know, there's the Free Syrian flag, there is someone waving a Yemeni flag. I was part of the queer bloc, which was waving a kind of progress flag mixed with the Palestine flag. And so it's definitely not, you know, get in line, but, you know, this is pretty suspicious and weird and don't do it and I don't know. But either way, he agreed. He folded the thing up, he put it in his pocket, and I went back to the person I was with, and it was like, okay, that happened. 5 minutes later, I see the same dude holding a different flag, a different A4 paper, with the Iranian flag of the Islamic Republic. I was so confused. Like, did he just have a complete change of heart in those like 5-10 seconds? Did I win him over or whatever, or like convince him? You know what I mean? And so I thought that was really suspicious. So I went to one of the organizers of the queer bloc and told them about it. And I mean, you know, aside from the whole chain of events, him holding the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran at this protest was not okay as well. Because the Islamic Republic, no matter what they say or what their proxies say, are not an ally of any of us in the region. They are their own imperialist power with their own state interests, and I think that's pretty clear. Anyway, sorry, I got much more political there than I intended to. She said, yeah, you should talk to him, ask him to take it down. When I went back, I couldn't find him. But the person I was with told me that someone else had actually spoken to him and scolded him and told him not to wave that flag and pointed that other person out, so I went and talked to them. Turns out they're half Tunisian, half something. They don't speak Arabic that much, but was telling me that, yeah, he just confronted this person. They didn't speak much, but they told him not to hold this flag. And the guy apparently just accepted and agreed and folded it up and left. And then I started telling him about the fact that he was holding that other flag. And that's really weird, you know? It's kind of like someone holding, I don't know, like a Syrian regime flag and then a Free Syria flag. Like, those are contradictory, you know? Literally, the Islamic Republic overthrew the Shah. And, like, it's just, it was very strange. And I swear to God, not 10 minutes later, there he is again, holding the same flag, the one with the lion, the Shah. And I went up to him again. I said, I thought we talked about this. And he showed me that he put a sticker that says Free Palestine onto the flag. So now it's okay. But I told him that doesn't change anything. And he kind of ignored me. And then 5 minutes later, as I'm deliberating, like, what do? Do I talk to other people? I notice he's changed flags again. And now he's holding the Islamic Republic flag. Like, I think he just, at a certain point, had both of them and was, like, flipping between them. And so I went up to him and I was like, listen, talk to me. What language do you speak? And he said Arabic, which confused me at first, because he had just told me he doesn't speak any Arabic. But, so that was, like, another alarm bells ringing. And so I was like, okay, so I started speaking to him in Arabic and asked him, why are you holding that flag? And he couldn't answer me. And I was like, wait, so where are you from? And he said, Syria. I was like, where in Syria? And he said, Halab. And I asked him, but why would you be waving a flag that represents a state that literally destroyed your city? And he couldn't answer. But not he couldn't answer like he was flabbergasted, like he didn't understand what I was saying. And I asked him then, what is your name? I asked him in Arabic. And he still gave me that same dumbfounded look that he has no idea what I'm saying. You know? Like, my Arabic is shit. But you ask, like, a 3-year-old, shuismak, like, it's basic Arabic. And so I was like, okay, no, something's sus up here. Something is very, very weird. And we get to the sort of main square. I go up to one of the organizers and of the main protest, and I start telling her. But at this point, he kind of also disappears, but also I'm talking to a lot of people. Like, at a certain point, I think the last time I confronted him, there were a few other people around me that are asking me, like, what's going on? And, like, as he's standing just a few centimeters away from me, I'm talking to them, you know, in Arabic and being like, this guy is a spy. This guy is an infiltrator. And it made me sound really paranoid. But, you know, as I was saying more and more, it became very obvious that, no, I'm not making this up. There's something very strange happening here. Small detail about this guy, he had a jacket on that had an emblem of the United Nations on the left and one for Austria on the right, which again, weird. When we get to the main square, which is basically where the protest ends, I notice he's running up front. I see him right up front waving those two papers. And yeah. So I go to the organizer, I tell her about it, we try and find him, I can't find him, and apparently other people had told him off. Word's getting around, you know, and I'm talking to a lot of people, and 5 minutes go by and there's a camera. There's some people doing interviews, and there I see him jump in front of the camera with these two flags, showing his UN, his supposed UN badge. And at this point, I rush towards him, three other people rush towards him, the organizer rush towards him, and we're like, what are you doing? Who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm just, you know, he wasn't speaking. And she's like, where are you from? And he said, Syria. And someone else asked him, where in Syria? Aleppo. And then one person had a very smart idea. She asked him, what's Aleppo in Arabic? And here, I mean, I for some reason didn't hear it the first time around, but when he said it this time, it was very clear. And okay, I remember him saying halab, because in Arabic there is a ha and a ha. And no matter what, if you are from Halab and you don't speak a damn word of Arabic, you know how to pronounce halab, you know? But other people say that he said halab, and that is sort of is a major red flag that he speaks Hebrew, he's an Israeli, he is a full-on Zionist infiltrator who, from the best that I can gather, wanted to falsely represent this protest as pro-Iran, and at the same time to represent the UN and Austria as being pro-Iran, and sort of, I don't know, trying to get seen so that manufactured consent, bullshit, whatever. And so once he says this line, we all instantly start glaring at him. And one guy with us, who I think is part of BDS Austria, says a great line. He goes, busted. It was a great moment. And at that point, the guy shat himself and turned around and was looking around. And then he kind of just bolted. He just ran. He took off his patches, threw them on the ground, ran a little bit, ran back to pick up the patches, put them back on. I don't know what that was about. Oh, small detail that I didn't mention because things kind of, I don't know, when I tell a story, I kind of go into a certain momentum. But I think like the second or third time I confronted him about the Islamic Republic flag, he had written on the Islamic Republic of Iran's flag using a Bic pen, women, life, freedom. And when we were confronting him, like, you are not Syrian, you are lying about being Syrian, you are doing something, you're up to something, he pulled out a necklace of Syria. And he's like, no, I am. So this is prepared. He was sent. I don't think he's doing this alone, but he had a plan, he prepared for this. And as inept and ridiculous and ludicrous as this whole thing is, like, this is a serious tactic. This is something that is known. I think when I was talking to someone in the crowd about it, he mentioned something about, I think the word was Mindassin or something like that, because it's a massive thing in the West Bank, you know? But these are like, let's say, a bit more trained. You know, they'd speak Arabic, they'd look a bit the part, and they would go with people who are protesting the Israeli occupation and then, like, burst out of their costumes and arrest people and drag them away to the soldiers. So it's much more intense and it's much more like an actual operation. this seems like some weird, I don't really understand, but it's like super high concept propaganda. And I don't know, I'm a little proud of myself that I caught on pretty early, you know, that I trusted my instincts. Like, in terms of this action, it seems pretty low stakes, I guess, because what was the very worst that could happen? The Austrian press thinks lowly of these protests. I mean, that happens anyway. But yeah, obviously there are some of these actors. And actually, why I was highly suspicious is because, A, we know that they do this. As in, this is like a literal piece of Zionist propaganda technique of like infiltrating and da-da-da. But I think I read only like a week ago on Twitter that there are some organizations paying people to do this, you know? Like, this guy could have gotten $50 just to do this thing or whatever. And given a name, given a whatever, do this, do that. I don't know. But it's definitely suspicious. And they could do more, you know? Like, it was kind of subtle in terms of the Iranian flag of whatever. When I talked to some people, they thought it was the Mexican flag. But not a lot of people know the flag of the Shah. And so, you know, I paid attention in geography class. no, but really. So there is an element of duplicity, of trying to be secretive, of trying to do something. And I think we should all be vigilant and aware of who are we sharing the streets with, and be very careful, you know? I do think I should have asked more questions once the flags switched, because, again, super fucking suspicious. But, yeah, crazy. Like, absolutely bonkers. Like, what kind of a plan is that? I was talking to a friend of mine, and they were like, wow, they actually made ChatGPT people. You know what I mean? Like, writing women life freedom on the Islamic Republic flag? I mean, get a Russian flag. Put Slava Ukraina, you know what I mean? Like, it's so ridiculous. And yeah, I don't know. That's that story. And so, yeah. This has been another episode of Politically Depressed. I hope you've enjoyed this quick and dirty episode. If you appreciate this podcast and the episodes I've been doing, please consider heading over to patreon.com/firethesetimes to support this podcast and become a member. And if you can't do that, then leave a review or a rating for this podcast, which really helps with the algorithm. And yeah, stay safe, everybody, and keep pushing for a fucking ceasefire, at least. Everybody. Welcome to another episode of Politically Depressed. As always, I'm your host, Eamon McAdam. Today's episode is a really special one, because I've invited my favorite writer to sit and talk with me. I wanted the very first guest on this podcast to be someone who I feel does the work that I want to do, only better, in a way that I can only aspire to. And that person is, and always has been, Lina Munzer. Both of us are writers. Both of us are from Beirut, which is the city at the center of a lot of our thinking and identity and sense of belonging, which is one of many reasons why I find her writing so fascinating and have always had a special place in my heart. I've read her work for years, and I found her ability to write evocative, personal, political pieces just completely unmatched. So that's why I was thrilled that she accepted to have this conversation with me, and the discussion you're about to listen to was just as nourishing and fascinating as I'd hoped. The version you're about to listen to is shortened for public release and is more concise, but there will also be an extended version which includes all the digressions and random stuff we talk about, and that'll be available for members of our Patreon. If you're not a member of our Patreon, head over to patreon.com/firethesetimes and become a member of our Patreon today. For as little as $5 a month, you help this podcast grow, but you'll also get exclusive content and early releases of all the podcasts under the Fire These Times, as well as an invitation to our monthly hangout. So, without further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode and the conversation you're about to listen to. Hi, Lina. Thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to introduce yourself in however you see fit?
Thank you so much for having me. It's very nice to be here from Vienna to Beirut. So my name is Lina Munzer. I'm a writer and a translator. And now I'm also the senior editor at arts and culture magazine called The Merkez Review. And that's pretty much it. I live in Beirut. It is both my vocation and my life and my obsession. And yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, you being in Beirut is something that's a big influence in terms of the things you write about, and especially my connection with things you write about, because even though I've left Beirut 2 years ago, it's still obviously my home. It's still the city that I feel most connected to, and I miss it so much. But at the same time, I know how, you know, I left for a reason, and those reasons have only gotten a bit more, let's say, accelerated.
Yes, concentrated.
Yeah. So I'm going to start right away with the really tough question, which is, how are you doing?
Oh, my God. I thought I was like 50-50 on if that's like a trick question or not. The really tough question, which is, what did you have for breakfast? Oh, my God. How am I doing? I don't have like a one word answer for that. I think I'm doing as well as anyone in this part of the world could be doing, or from this part of the world, or actually, what am I even saying? Anybody with two eyes and a heart and a conscience, I think, is not doing well at all and is finding it very, very, very difficult to cope with the current times. But yeah, I mean, I was just speaking to a writer earlier, and we were talking about, like, a writer who's writing something for the magazine. And we were talking about how when you greet people in Arabic, you know, he was telling me that there's all this grief behind it, because just someone speaking to you in Arabic is like, that's the language in which the tragedy is unfolding. And so even if you say something innocuous, like, hi, how are you, in Arabic, you hear all of that grief behind those words, because they carry the fact that, like, none of us are coping very well with this current situation, you know, this genocide that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely experienced that here as well. I've been meeting, through these protests that I've been going to, a lot more Arabs, queer Arabs, Syrians and Egyptians, Palestinians. And yeah, even just the hi, hello, how are you? And like, and obviously there's so much like within the language itself and within the kind of culture around the language. So like this thing of Aishin, how are you? Oh, we're living. It embodies so much.
Yeah.
And good and bad, insofar as it's so sad that we're at that point, but it also holds that kind of, you know, at least we're still alive. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And readdressing the kind of priorities there. Because the thing that I can't stand more than anything else is hearing white people complain.
I know. Can I tell you, one of the reasons why I feel like I can never leave Beirut is so that I don't have to hear white people complain.
Yeah. Again, it's a push and pull. It's great. Yeah. Like, it's great being sure that if I hear a plane, it's definitely not Israel. Like, it's just some commercial whatever. But at the same time, it's just been incredibly alienating. And I kind of don't leave the house much.
You know, everybody abroad who lives abroad has been telling me that, including my mother, who has been living in Canada for the last, you know, 30 some years, like left during the end of the Civil War and never came back. except for like brief visits, and has no real desire to return, and none of that nostalgia. For her, it was like, this place has been so difficult, and, you know, and her life is so much easier there. But she told me that she feels completely alienated, and she finds it so difficult to, like, you know, and my mom is like Smala, very active, for, you know, she's like taking Italian lessons, and she goes to like these various classes and stuff. And she was telling me that, like, she almost didn't want to go to class anymore because of the way that people are talking about what's happening. And she's like, I just feel disgusted. I can't speak to anybody. You know, one of my really good friends just came from the US for like 2 weeks for a visit, and just like left last week. And she was like, I had to come here to like decompress, you know, to like be with people where I like, they can understand all of what I'm going through, and I don't have to explain myself. And it's just, so I found that like really interesting. Like, it's the middle of a war, and we are at war here in Lebanon. And there's a lot of tension about how far it's going to spread as well. And yet she came here in order to like decompress and like get enough energy to be able to go back there and continue her life there, you know, where she is safe, but where she also feels entirely alienated from everybody yeah. around her. And it's not that there are no sympathizers, quote unquote, or like, I mean, there's plenty, you know, we talk about white people and whatever, but like, you know, fundamentally, really, it's kind of like just a really broad category, because what we're really talking about is like, I don't know, these kind of like up their asses first worlders, which can be any color of person, frankly, and any nationality. So there are a lot of people that, you know, you meet at protests and people who really care deeply about what's happening. But I think that the experience of probably being in a city where everything just continues functioning as normal. I was in France for 2 weeks in like at the end of January, and I was in Montpellier for a week, and then I was in Paris for a week, and they were so needed. Like, that's what gave me the energy to be able to continue. But at the same time, it was really jarring to go there and be like, oh, like life is just continuing apace for people. Like, they just wake up and they go to cafes, and they like, it was so weird because like life is not normal here in Beirut, you know, it's just not normal. So in a way, you feel like you feel sane, you know, when the world around you mirrors that.
So like, that's exactly where I've been thinking a lot about, where it's like, it doesn't feel normal, but in a way it feels more normal than here. Like this mm-hmm. being here in Europe feels like living in the delusion, mm-hmm. like living in the bubble. So, okay, there's actually one thing that I do want to talk about, because we're recording this now in 2024. And what I find happening a lot when I talk about things, and especially now that I've started this podcast only a couple months ago, I am talking almost exclusively about Gaza. Mm-hmm. But when I'm talking about collapse, when I'm talking about this state of mind, this kind of alienation and everything, it's been years. And so I find myself talking about 2020 and 2021 and kind of flattening it, you know. But a big reason why I wanted you to be, you know, the very first guest on this podcast, on this show, because I remember your writing was keeping me sane. And I felt like I had a similar task. I took on the same task as you. I saw what you were doing, and I felt like that's what I want to do, which is to name the thing. Because 2021 sounds like a one thing, but it was a long, slow, absurd process that just had so many, every day was a new situation. Uh-huh. And so it felt like a really important task to name what we're all experiencing. And some of my like proudest, you know, some of my feelings of achievement is the moment that I was able to name it mm-hmm. and to help others by sharing it. Mm-hmm. But however, I have noticed, you know, and this is going back a couple of years already, but definitely even now, that there was a point when we kind of just stopped. There was a feeling where it's like, I can't keep naming this. Like, it's because I named it a week ago and it's completely changed now. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if I wanted to bring that up and ask you, like, Do you remember when that moment was, when it was like, I can't keep trying to keep up because it's, I feel like it was exhausting. And it got to the point where it's almost pointless, because we're hitting a point of collapse, of absurdity that defies
description.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. For me, when I just stopped, it was very clear. So what happened was 2021, what you referred to as 2021, for me, it's like it began with like October 2019 yeah. with the uprising, just in terms of this incredible shift. And I think that the way that we have been living since then is with a complete inability to picture the future, which is like a really exhausting way to live, right? Like you cannot picture the future because you literally don't know what it's going to look like. You don't know what the circumstances are going to be like. You don't know what is going to happen. And, you know, and it's like this destabilization that you're living in. So in fact, having to name things almost becomes a kind of survival mechanism, like a way to survive, because you're trying to create stable ground underneath your feet, like because you are living in an ever-shifting landscape. And, you know, it's constant. It's like these earthquakes constantly. So we went from, you know, the joy of the uprising to as it, you know, sort of crumbled into despair. And then all of the little moments like of the economic crisis. And it went through so many phases, right? It was like the times when we were queuing in the banks, the times when the banks were allowing us to withdraw, when the banks stopped allowing us to withdraw, when, you know, and then all the shortages, like, oh, this week there's no meat, this week there's no water, this week there's no electricity, no fuel, da, 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 da. You know, so it's like a constantly having to adapt. And then there was the port explosion, right? And for me, I always thought about it like those two things, like 2019, the uprising, and then the port explosion in 2020. Like, it was like two bookends in a way of like going to the extremes of your imagination in both directions. Like, I never imagined that there would be an uprising, and I never imagined what it would feel like. And it was so incredible and like world bending and mind bending and mind expanding and heart expanding and, you know, all of these things. It was like really, you know, it was like an experience that, I mean, I feel very privileged that I got to experience it, right? It was like almost like a spiritual experience. It was so, it like transformed the entire landscape. And then on the other extreme was the port explosion, which is, you know, I'm one of the ways that I've always described it is like, you know, growing up here, I grew up during the Civil War. I feel like I am a person who is to a certain extent inured to violence, or at least I can imagine so many different iterations of it. Car bombs, airstrikes, you know, street fighting, gunfights, etc. You know, all of these things. So I have like a whole vocabulary of violence, right, that I can refer to. And so when the port explosion happened, it was like, oh, there's still things that I cannot even imagine, like a kind of violence or a kind of disruption or a kind of that I can't even imagine, you know? So it was like these two limits of imagination on either side, you know, from like the most joyous to the absolute worst. And, you know, and still there was this need to try and understand and grasp, et cetera, et cetera. And then I had a literature residency at the end of 2021 in Switzerland. And so up until that point, I had been writing a column. I was writing a column for Orion, which was like a local paper. And then I was also writing for the New York Times, who, God forgive me, I will never write for them again. Not that they would ever ask me to do so again. But anyway, so at the time it was like, I was also writing for them pretty regularly. So like my job was to kind of try and explain what was happening, both to a foreign audience and to a local audience. And it was quite interesting actually having the experience of like writing to a local audience and a foreign audience at the same time. Obviously I wrote very different kinds of things and different kinds of ways. Anyway, then I went to Switzerland and I think that's when I fell silent. I don't know that I've really written anything that is like very significant since then. I mean, I've written other stuff, but I haven't, you know, it was so jarring for me to go from, you know, I went to this like beautiful little village in like the foot of the foothills of the Jura Mountains. And, you know, I had this little studio that like overlooked a vast green valley. And then there was like Lake Geneva in the distance and then the Alps behind it. Right. And here's this like tiny village with like one local store and herds of cows feeding on like emerald green grass. And then the way you know it's evening is you hear their bells like gently sort of, you know, tolling as they walk back to their house. And I was like, oh, the whole time that we were living that, this was here. And people were like living this. And, you know, and all the people that I met there was like, you know, writers from around the world. Everybody was talking about like the trauma of COVID and like how traumatic COVID was. And it was, again, so jarring. I'm like, COVID was really the least of our worries. Like, it was like the least of our problems. Like, it sort of came on top of everything and like complicated and like made everything so much shittier. But like, I don't know about you, but like, I remember our fear of COVID was our health system is collapsing. I don't trust any, like, it's not just about having COVID. It's about getting really sick and having to go to a hospital where there's like a shortage of medicine, shortage of beds, shortage of doctors. Like, you know, like that, how the fuck do you even do that? Like, it's just, and, you know, I find it kind of absurd, like, I'm saying all of these things now, because, like, in light of the situation with Gaza, like, all of this is so much more stark and so much more jarring and so much more horrible. But, like, it, you know, it was that. We were living these extreme circumstances. And then all of a sudden you go to a place and you're like, oh, like, life was just going on, like, here, as, like, people were dying of hunger in Lebanon and like, you know, entire families are like reduced to begging in the streets and people are like literally committing suicide because they can no longer pay for children's tuition. Like just this extreme misery of people's life savings gone completely. And then it's like, you have this little village where like the cows have just been coming home every night, you know? Anyway, it's like, so since then for me, I think it was like, it was very hard to kind of go back and find a way back. And I think now I found it very difficult to write because I think that being in Lebanon is a very particular position of what's happening right now. Cause I feel like we have a front row seat to the atrocities that are taking place. Like there's a genocide happening in Gaza. There is also war in the southern part of the country. We cannot look away from what's happening. I feel like we are like sitting Clockwork Orange style with like our eyes sort of like that. And we're watching like literally a horror movie, but we also don't know if it's the preview to our sequel that we're going to star in. Right. And so again, we're living in this way where we cannot predict or understand or visualize the future, except, but we're, it's not our tragedy yet or now. So I feel almost like it's hard for me to talk about it. Like I can't even talk about it, right? Like it's like everybody I know is like living with this fear, but then like how do you quantify fear against what we're seeing actually happen to people every day, right? So to me it feels like silence is the only thing that I like I can just keep quiet. Like I feel ashamed even of telling you like I'm afraid and I'm less afraid now, but like, you know, the first few weeks I was like, I was like waking up with in a panic in the middle of the night, you know, because I was just like listening to the silence and imagining it like filled with airstrikes and just, and I was just feeling like, I'm like, well, where are we going to go? Like, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? You know, there's nowhere to run like from that kind of, anyway. Sorry, that was like a very long answer. But like, yeah, I think part of it is, you know, you're in this situation where, you know, the short answer to what you asked, you're in this situation where you can't visualize the future. So you have to keep naming the present. And at some point, that just becomes the way that you live. And so you, that compulsion is no longer there, even, you know, because you're trying to name something because it feels new, right? It feels so unprecedented and new. And then when you've lived that way for a long time, you're like, well, that's just it.
No, no, thank you for all of that. Actually, there's so much that you said that, I mean, because you described exactly the task that I had given myself as a kind of, early writer when I was still in Beirut, which was this sort of, I am giving myself the task to be here and to document and to analyze and to share and synthesize, because that's a kind of skill that I have. But for me, the day of the explosion, it's a bit of a funny story, actually. I had a friend over who was my editor at the time, still a very good friend. And we were writing an essay together called Hope or Despair, because I'm glad that you mentioned the 2019 uprisings, because it's true. That is the moment that, like, kind of this history, this short history starts for me. Everything before that feels like a bit of a blur. I actually, in a previous lifetime, wrote a TV series based in Beirut called Beirut Syndrome, which now is like historical fiction, because I wrote this in 2018. It's so different. It's like so premised on this thing of like, I hate Beirut, but if I leave, it's whatever. It's like a bittersweet thing. And now it's like, no, there's none of that charm of that, like, ye. But so from 2019, obviously momentum and then dipped and everything. So I was writing this essay called Hope or Despair because I'm noticing a lot of people, and I felt my goal was to keep my finger on the pulse and to be able to name the thing. That to me is like a moment of success. If I write something, like the one essay that I feel like I wrote at the time that did this was an essay called like Depression and Revolution. And I got a lot of people who, like, I was, standing at the time, these like revolutionary, cool feminist, whatever, writing me and being like, thank you for saying this. And I was like, oh my God, you're saying thank you to me? No, thank you. But so we were writing this essay, Hope or Despair. Like, we were writing, have we hit rock bottom? And then boom.
Literally, boom.
This thing that's, this thing that's completely impossible to imagine. Like, there is no conception of the port as a dangerous place. And so what happened after that is this thing of like, to where's the next one? There's this incredible thing that I've heard so many people recount, which is those split second thoughts. And the apartment I was living in at the time was right next to Hariri's castle, in Er Eytim. And this was, I think, the day of or the week that they were going to announce the findings of the tribunal of who assassinated Hariri, Rafiq Hariri. And so I remember in that split second being like, oh, it's an airstrike, it's an attack on Hariri's convoy somewhere near this. But so basically what happened after that is because the Pandora's box is open, that the unknown is so present, and we have no idea and we cannot predict, that then I became very scared all the time. And I was always worried about when's the next thing going to happen and where's whatever. And like a week later, the port was on fire. And so like there was a feeling, like not a feeling, every single day something new was happening. And it just eventually I gave up.
If you remember, there were lots of fires that month after. I don't know if you remember, there were a lot of fires for some reason. And like there was this whole thing of like, oh, the extinguisher was, there was like a big fire in Kola. There was like a motor that exploded. There was like fires at the port. There was so much actually. There was such a sense of danger. There really was, you know?
That's, I mean, it was the moment after the port because I'd been debating back and forth, but after the explosion, I was like, I'm leaving. I can't. And I remember,
I know several people who like packed up and left in the weeks afterwards, like just,
yeah, I mean, well, for me, I don't have a passport, so I got married, and it took me like 8 months to get the paperwork, and within those 8 months were really torturous. But I remember I almost stopped applying. And I kind of got used to things. But then December 25, the Israeli jets that shot over Beirut to Lat'i or something. And again, because in that moment,
That was terrifying. That was really,
that was really terrifying. And again, when I saw it, I remember thinking to myself, they're nuking us. And I didn't feel crazy for thinking it. So you know what I mean? Like, because the possibilities are endless and khalas, there's nothing that's impossible for me anymore. And I'm constantly living in this idealized, like, worst case scenario. The way that I describe this long moment is that feeling when you're leaning back on a chair and you hit that point of no return and your heart drops because you know you've lost touch with the balance. But it was like perpetual. It was like a constant feeling of falling. And that's exactly what I like escaped from. And so, but again, but when I was there, there was this feeling of I'm not going to write anymore because just surviving it is enough. And I'm not able to name any of this. And so I don't know. So I really wonder then, like, what is the role of writers then? Because if silence feels like the only the right thing to do.
I have a friend who's a novelist who told me not so long ago that he said that, like, silence is part of the writing process, like that you go through periods of silence sometimes. And that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, I think that that's like very wise and very true. And yeah, it's like sometimes you just have to gather your words. You know, for me, the role of a writer is, you know, I was like, I wrote this piece after the explosion, and I really felt like it was like a sort of correspondence with a friend of mine who also a writer who lives in the States. And we sort of published this like series of letters between each other. But, you know, I always, to me, it became very much crystallized at that point. But I don't like this like pontification of like the role of the writer in, you know, in tragedy or catastrophe or whatever, or blah, blah, blah. I think like when it comes to certain things, it's like we all have to like roll up our sleeves and get to work and do the thing that we do best, like whatever it is. And to me, writing is one of those things, like, you know, and like you said, it's like the job is to name, is to describe, but it could also be like to, you know, that's the other thing that I think about. It's like so much of the edict of like writers from this part of the world or from, let's say, parts of the world that like endure catastrophe is like you are asked to be a documentarian. And so somehow you're not allowed to use your imagination. You know, you are not allowed to make things up or to have, let's say, like that your goals are like really aesthetic literary goals as opposed to, you know, so I also reject that, you know, that this idea, like, if you want to describe, you can describe, if you want to create like escape worlds, you can also do that. You know, this all of it's like you just, I think for me, the point of it is work, you know, to do like a kind of to do a kind of work, to be able to do a kind of work. But like, to do a work that is somehow useful. And by this, you know, I don't mean like the busy work of capitalism. I mean, I do think that there's something called like a labor of love, and it's like love in action. That to me is what writing is somehow, because I love it. So, I love it as much as I hate it. Yeah.
I've been discovering that the thing that I hate most about writing is writing. And then editing and everything. And that's why I've moved towards podcasting and really reframing how I'm conceiving of. I've seen Susan Sontag in conversation with John Berger. It was a really cool conversation, actually. I randomly discovered it a week ago about storytelling, and that the writer is another name for the storyteller, but more with this idea of written word. But I do think I come from a much longer line of oral tradition of storytelling. And a part of writing for me is this kind of connection. Again, and that is something that I've learned from you, that when I read your work, there's that feeling of being seen. Again, it's not necessarily learning something new, but having confirmed something that I always felt but was not able to synthesize and to put into words. And yeah, you're right. A part of it is imagining. A part of it is, I think one of my favorite essays you've written is this one that sort of parallels the sewers of Beirut with the post-war destruction and construction, let's say. Because, yeah, analogies and metaphors are really powerful when done well. But yeah, in this present moment, it feels like constantly deliberating, like, so what are we meant to do? Because, not meant to do, there's things that are very obvious and immediate, but it's questioning or throwing up so many conceptions we already had that, like, all we need to do is name it or show it, you know? But absolutely, what we're finding... Yeah, yeah. And what I think so much of the dilemma of so many Palestinians in Gaza is that what more do you want us to show you? Like, what is the image? What is the number? What is it that once we show, things will change, because they've been showing some of the most extreme, horrific, like evident cases, and then nothing's shifting. And there's this kind of, I've been thinking a lot about Mu'taz, the journalist, because he's left. And so it's like, obviously, an extreme example of some of those experiences that we've been talking about, of like now experiencing genocide from outside and knowing it's still happening while the world's going around. So seeing him at an airport, you know, for the first time in his life, at a 25-year-old man. But yeah, there's this, he's been talking about, he left and his mission is, well, he did what he could there and nothing was changing. So he wants to go out and be like, what's going on? What do you want to see?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's like this. And I always think about like Mahmoud Darwish's book, Zakira al-Nisyan, A Memory for Forgetfulness. It's basically a memoir of a single day in August in 1982 during the Israeli bombardment of West Beirut, which was extremely violent, extremely brutal, very much like what's happening in Gaza. I think they killed something like 17,000 people within like a month. And I mean, obviously they've surpassed those records now, but it like just absolute brutality. And like, you know, the also trying out new weapons on people and, you know, things like the indescribable things that some people talk about. And like, you know, they flattened a lot of West Beirut. Anyway.
There's a good essay by Justin Salhani about drawing these comparisons. And we've done an episode for the Fire These Times talking about these parallels and these sort of stories from 82. I think even Darwish was living in Beirut at the time.
Yeah, he was. He talks about being, yeah, I saw Justin's essay when he goes to Sabra and you know, Shatila and talks to the people there as well, you know, about what's, you know, their memories then versus now. But yeah, so Mahmoud Darwish, Zakira al-Nisyan is set in Beirut and it's about like a single day about that. And so, you know, a lot of it is also, he sort of goes back and forth in time. It's like a very long prose poem. And I love it because to me, it's also like, it's almost like an instructional on how to write about war during wartime, right? And so there's like a line or a scene that I always come back to where he says, you know, what good is poetry when people have been reduced to such a state of nature that they are rejoicing over water gushing from a broken pipe on the road, right? Because there's no water. So like people are like, there's a water line that breaks and like everybody rushes towards it to like drink this dirty water. And so it's like, you know, he shows like people are reduced, quote unquote, to this state. And at this, so like what good is writing? What good is poetry? You know, what good is naming things or like creating something beautiful or even imagining when this is what war does to people, you know? And the whole book is somehow an attempt to answer that question and also not really give it any clear answer. But I mean, that's why I think that the function of writing has to be more than simply just naming and describing and, you know, what it is, I don't know. I think that that's something that the reader decides, you know. I don't think it's necessarily up to the writer. I think it's the reader who decides. And at the same time, it's like you also can't, like, mafik tamlo, like you can't load it with that much as well, you know. Like it's not going to change everything, you know. It's not going to be like this one thing that happens. It's an accumulation. I mean, again, we literally, besides all of the horrors that have been taking place and like all of us seeing the worst images we've ever seen, we also saw somebody literally light themselves on fire, you know, in order to draw attention. And there are still people who are like completely with blinders on, like absolutely refusing to look or to, you know, anyway.
There are so many things that I feel like should move people. And it's so jarring to see people not moved and continuing with the same inertia. There is actually another piece of media from 1982, which is Jocelyne Saab's Beirut Mavir. And that to me is also a really interesting example. I return to it as well, of how to document war or how to do something, because it's not just a documentation. She does do her own. There is artistic choices and there are Or the other day, I watched Jenin Jenin by Mohamed Bakri. And there was a choice there to have the one character, the one person that he's been interviewing that sort of carries you throughout the film, who is this mute man who's sort of with his hands playing out what he saw over there, this and the gun and the explosion or whatever. Like, I don't know what any of this means. I will think a lot about it, but it's this idea that, yeah, there's still room for new ways of conceiving writing and doing art, because the problem is it feels gross to do anything, but it also feels gross to do nothing.
I agree. I mean, that's why it really is to me, like, you roll up your sleeves and you get to work if you can.
There's a lot of ego that I think needs to go.
Yes.
And that I've definitely, you know what I mean? Like, of just, I'm not just a writer. And there's not like a status of, no, I'm a writer. I'm not going to go hand out pamphlets or go post whatever. There's a kind of owning up to your own like civic duty or your own political duty and your own, I don't know.
No, of course. To me, this happens when you feel like you're part of a community. To me, this happens like almost automatically when you feel like you're part of a community. It's like, you know, after the explosion, like everybody fucking rolled up their sleeves and went out and like helped clean up the streets and distributed food and, you know, reached out to people in need. And like, you know, I know other people who, you know, who gave up their time, like volunteering as medics and, you know, like all kinds of stuff. Like you, people just kind of did what had to be done in all of these. And that's, I mean, in a way I think about writing as part of that, or like writing to describe as part of that. It's like, you do what has to be done in some way, like, you know what I mean? Like as part of your other civic responsibilities, which is what, like, I feel like, you know, a lot of the journalists on the ground in Gaza, I mean, that's how they're documenting things. You know, it's like, let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. Like, this is what we're doing. This is what we have to do. It's, you know, and some of them do it along with food distribution, with aid distribution, with this, with that. And, you know, it's like, yeah, to me, these are part and parcel of the same thing. And it's, you know, just to like circle back to what you said at the very beginning, you know, it's this idea of community where you were saying, like, in Beirut, you feel part of a community because everybody is going through the same thing. And like, they'll tell you, alhamdulillah, as-salame after the explosion. Or, you know, I remember also after the earthquake, which again was one of those things where we can't talk about it because like what happened in Syria and Turkey is so horrible, but it was pretty terrifying in Lebanon as well. Before we knew that it was like so devastating in Syria and Turkey, I was like, it was really like one of the scariest things that I've ever lived through. And it was, anyway, and it was like a pretty, I think it was like a 5.1 here, which, you know, again, in a country where everything is falling apart and like buildings just collapse for no reason. But yeah, again, you go out on the street the next day, everybody's like, alhamdulillah, salame, how do you feel? What's happening? Da, da, da. And it's like, I wrote this in an essay that, like, you know, for me, what Lebanon is for me, I realized, like, after all these years having grown up here and da, 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 is like, it's a community of shared grief. And that's the way I know how to build community out of shared grief. And that's why I find it so hard to not live here, frankly, because I always find community in that, you know, and that's it. I mean, it's the place where I have to explain myself the least. Hello. Am I going to run away when the war starts? Probably. But yeah.
I think you hit on the perfect ending point, because essentially this whole podcast project is building a community, an online community that I can curate, but also participate in, of shared grief.
I mean, it is called political depression. So
politically depressed.
Oh, politically depressed. Okay.
But, and so because I'm alone here, I don't have a community of shared grief, and I don't recognize people's eyes here. You know, there is pain, there is hurt, there is trauma, but I don't recognize it. And it's so, it puts me in this like weird situation where I obviously don't want to take up too much space and be like, wait, I'm in the diaspora. I hate how safe everything is and how quiet everything is. It's not, but at the same time, I feel like obviously not talking about it compounds. But yeah, so building a community around grief and despair and trying to like accept it and not resist it, because I think a part of the problem that I've always
and laugh about it.
I do have a few jokes in my podcast. I do a very good Zizek impersonation. I did in the last episode. That was fun. I do some characters off The Simpsons, like Mr. Burns. But no, yeah, like the story about the explosion. And there was actually another funny element to it. You know, before it happened, we'd ordered food. And then it happened, and we're all sat around the TV, and we're calling people. People are calling us. There's chaos. There's terror. What is it? What is it? Is it a strike? Is a war starting? What? There's a knock on the door. And we're all freaking out. We go open the door. It's the guy from Malek Al Tawouk. And we're staring at him, just three of us. And he is like, Mam Sadu, you don't believe what, you know? And we're like, oh, we just start breaking out laughing, all like four of us. It's a funny story because whatever, but it's also a really terrifying story about how the wheels of capitalism really just don't stop even after an explosion. The guy still came. But anyway.
I hope you tipped him really well.
Really well, really well. Like there was this kind of like, take everything, just go, oh my God.
Speaking of community, of shared grief, I mean, for me, during that time, I know it sounds silly, but like, there were so many of us on Twitter that got to know each other on Twitter and through Twitter. And you know, you're one of those people for me. It's like, there's people that we would like, you know, share things, talk about things, comment on things. Da, da, da. And there was like, you know, there's like a group of Lebanese people from that time that to me, like, I will always have affection for that group of people, because we really were kind of like all going through these things in real time together, you know? And yeah, that's like one of the good things about online communities is like, you know, it wasn't just the people around me who I was seeing and telling me Alhamdulillah Salima in person. It was also the people who were in different parts of the city or in different parts of the country, also living through this stuff, talking about it on Twitter. And, you know, so yeah.
I actually remember that so much. And I have one last anecdote about it. I remember a few weeks after the explosion, I was up at late at night because I stay up really late. And it was like 3 a.m., 4 a.m. And there was a thunderstorm. And I heard the bolt of lightning, or sorry, the thunder. And obviously I felt it like, oh my God, that's an explosion. But I could see the light. So the very first thing I did was I opened up Twitter and I wrote, don't worry, guys, it was just thunder. And again, all the people you're talking about instantly right after mine were waking up and be like, what was that? What was that? What was that? What was
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
And I would respond to them like really quickly to read, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. And yeah, I miss that. I think a lot of those people have either moved away or ceased to feel. I mean, I'm still on Twitter and Twitter itself has changed a lot.
Yes, very much. But I do find that like around Gaza now, there is like a also a community of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that sounds like a very similar community that I'm trying to build for myself around this podcast. And my God, I've gotten some really heartwarming responses to my podcast. Just like, thank you. Like I've been feeling these things and it's hard to express them. So like, thanks for naming it. And
that's not nothing. That is something, you know? Like, that is something pretty significant.
Thank you. I mean, it's sorry, I try to do what I can. And okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation. And I knew it was going to be amazing.
Thank you for having me.